What's up, Boozerinos? I'm Erica.
And I'm Hillary.
And this is Cocktails and Capitalism.
Woo!
We are drinking the Hot Toddy today, which is another one of Jack London's favorites. It's one of my favorites too, actually. It's so fucking easy to drink and just pleasant. And especially since it's cold out right now, it's like the perfect drink.
Yeah, it's one of my old favorites too. I really like it. It always reminds me of one of my friends from Virginia because she used to drink them when she got sick.
Oh, yeah.
So her husband would come home and she'd be all just snickering on the couch having a good time. And he's like, are you okay? She's like, yeah, I'm okay. I just have a sore throat.
You stayed home from work to party?
Totally.
That's great. My mom was telling me that her mom used to give her hot toddies as a cold remedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, it's a funny thing because it's going to drop your immune system at the same time.
Totally, yeah.
Maybe it helps. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the thinking was that like the alcohol would kill the germs.
Yeah.
Like, that's not accurate, but I like it. I'll go with it.
Totally. So funny. If only we could fight COVID by just drinking booze.
Oh, we'd be set.
I know. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, we'd be rocking and rolling.
Only it worked that way.
If only. Womp womp.
Womp womp.
Womp womp.
So I'm going to dive right the fuck in because I want to go through a ton of stuff.
Let's do it. I'm excited. I've been really into this. 3 episodes worth of this stuff. It's fucking awesome.
And I actually tried to distill it down, but also like crammed in all these other phases of his life that are so important to touch on because they all relate to capitalism. They all relate to his political economic views. And
yeah, I mean, you wrote a dissertation on it. Like, it could easily be an entire podcast and not just three episodes.
It's like, true. It's fucking true.
So I'm impressed that you've even been able to cram it into 3 episodes. That's baller. You're a baller.
Thanks, babe. Baller Boozerino.
I'm Baller Boozerino. Yeah. Love it.
All right. So I think where I left off was he was going back into becoming a wage slave again and trying to get all kinds of odd jobs just to make ends meet. News of the discovery of gold in the Klondike immediately struck a chord with this young man who was so desperate for both money and escape from wage slavery. Furthermore, the Klondike appealed to London's hunger for adventure and his desire for the freedom and nobility of character that a life in such a sublimely rugged environment would foster. Financed by his stepsister Eliza, who was forced to take a $1,500 mortgage out on her house, London and his brother-in-law headed north on July 25th, 1897. The same year, the Northern Pacific Railroad Company published a mandatory list of supplies that gold seekers must bring to the Klondike. It included a year's supply of food that the Canadian government required every man to carry with him into the region as a safeguard against mass starvation in this hostile setting. Every individual had to bring 150 pounds of bacon, 400 pounds of flour, 25 pounds of rolled oats, 125 pounds of beans, 10 pounds of tea, 10 pounds of coffee, 25 pounds of sugar, 25 pounds of dried potatoes, 2 pounds of dried onions, 15 pounds of salt, 1 pound of pepper, 75 pounds of dried fruit, 8 pounds of baking powder, 2 pounds of soda, 1/2 pound of evaporated vinegar, 12 ounces of compressed soup, and 1 can of mustard.
Just 1 can? God, mustard's my favorite.
Yeah, that's a weird thing.
I know, seriously. I would have been like 70 cans of mustard.
I think when you have to bring all this shit, you're going to be like, I'm not going to bring a drop more because this is over 1/2 ton of food that you have to carry.
That's so much.
Basically.
That's so much.
It's fucking insane. Yeah. So it's 1,095 pounds.
I mean, I still advocate for more mustard, though.
I love it. Dude, when I make sandwiches, I just pour a little side of mustard that I dip them into.
Oh, God, I am so going to adopt that. That's fantastic.
It's really good. I love mustard.
What the fuck? You are brilliant.
Thanks, babe.
That's amazing. That's like a life hack that I've needed my entire life.
I know people dip everything into ketchup, but
no. Mustard is where it's at. That like super tart flavor. It's my fave.
Yeah, totally.
So good. Mustard on every goddamn thing.
I like just putting mustard on pickles or mustard on cheese or mustard on deli meat or anything.
Yeah, totally.
So fucking good. Mm-hmm. So over half a ton of food, or 1,095 pounds, was demanded for each man and was weighed by the Canadian government before each prospector was permitted entry. Even with such provisions, London spoke of the, quote, chronic state of famine, end quote, that he experienced in the Yukon. In The Economics of the Klondike, an article written a couple years after his gold hunting venture, London explains that every spring brought a mass migration of gold hunters to the area, after which, quote, every winter found the miners on the edge of famine.
Ugh.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Everyone's going, bringing that much fucking food and you're still starving.
Yeah.
So this article describes the insanity of prospector expenditures in the Klondike relative to total gains in gold, providing a macroeconomic view of this period of gold hunting in the region. According to London's estimates, $220 million have been spent in extracting $22 million from the ground. So 10 times as much was spent on just getting out there as was actually extracted in gold.
That's so wild. Like, is that even worth it?
No. I mean, all these people throwing away their life savings, taking mortgages out on their houses so that they can go up and strike it rich, you know? Uh-huh.
Scam.
Yep, totally.
It's like the original Amway.
Totally. It reminds me of Grapes of Wrath too.
Yes.
It's like, oh, come out west and we'll have all these jobs for you and it's gonna be great, and then they all come out and then it's like, oh, we can take your labor for no pay because we have all these people here now wanting jobs. So
just these empty promises of a totally fulfilled life.
Yeah, it's such a sad thing, but also I think it's really cool that he was thinking about it in this way.
Yeah,
look at total input and total output, and how is it not make sense to even do any of this?
Yeah, totally.
So the majority of the wealth filled the coffers of the transportation and the outfitting companies. So just the companies that gave them their supplies and transported them were making buttloads.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, all these little businesses that sprout up around this industry that is making no money.
Yeah. You know?
Crazy. So London concluded that perhaps more than all other causes combined, the food shortage has been the greatest detriment in the development of that region, something he accurately asserted would be eliminated by advancements in local transportation technology. So venturing into the area prior to these advancements, London was forced to divide his supplies into 15 loads of up to 100 pounds. These he carried one at a time, going back for the next pack after caching the prior pack. This meant he was forced to travel nearly 30 miles for every mile of the trail.
Because of the back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah. Just to
that
move
is
his
a
shit.
Narnar workout. Like,
oh my God.
So much weight back and forth. Like, he must have been pretty ripped.
Oh, yeah. He was already pretty ripped from all the work that he was doing, but he was like extra ripped at this point in his life.
Yeah, that's cray cray.
So, like 30 miles for every mile of the trip, during half of which he was burdened by an enormous amount of food and other provisions. He even outpacked the locals who were frequently hired by prospectors to carry in supplies. In this fashion, London and a few companions he acquired, his ailing brother-in-law having already abandoned the mission, traversed the dreaded Chilkoot Pass. On this impossibly steep and treacherous path, London was forced to walk again and again over a trail covered in dead horses that had been trampled flat by the passing hordes. As a long-time animal lover, London was deeply disturbed by this scene. These mutilated creatures had been unwisely purchased as pack animals for use in an inhospitable environment, and those who didn't fall from the trail starved from the lack of forage. So sad.
Yeah, that's really fucking sad.
That struck me so hard when I learned that. Like, ugh, walking over horses, no.
I would, my heart would just crumble so fucking bad. Like,
yeah, I would never have made it.
No, me neither. I would have maybe lasted 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Let's be real. I mean, I'm just being like, honest.
The first shuttle for your food, and then you're like, wait a minute, I have to move all these other ones? Fuck that.
Yeah, totally.
So many times, London was challenged to defy the forces of nature during this expedition. With some help from another prospector, London built two 27-foot-long boats out of spruce trees they had felled.
Oh, damn.
With the first... Yeah, isn't that fucking cool?
I, like, how did he even have time to do that? That's amazing.
Well, you just, like, fucking set up a camp and start hacking down trees and hollowing them out and burning out the inside so that you can, like, carve out the wood.
Yeah, yeah. That's
but
wild.
But it would take you forever.
I know. That's so, what I'm thinking. Like, just...
Yeah.
Damn.
So he built two of those.
Impressive.
So with the first blizzard of the year in full force, London chose to lead his unofficial team through a number of incredibly risky shortcuts. As men gathered to watch the dangerous feat, London steered his full boat through the infamous Box Canyon as well as the White Horse Rapids. Had he not been so skilled at navigating treacherous waters, this shortcut would have ended with the loss of all supplies and the lives of all aboard. He even went back for a family who would likely have drowned without his assistance, braving the terrible waters repeatedly. Unlike many travelers who abandoned their journeys and made camp for the winter rather than risk death by crossing a rapidly freezing lake, London refused to give up. His team made it across the lake safely, only to look back over a frozen surface the next morning. Many despondent prospectors who had accepted defeat were now embarking on their return voyage, and these men carried the news that, quote, there was not enough food in Dawson to last through the winter, and the whole of the gold mining area was already staked out. Thus, London's team elected to make camp and prospect within the vicinity.
Are we having troubles with V's today?
We'll see. This hot toddy is just starting to hit me. So.
Oh, nice.
Feels nice.
Oh, hey, let's cheers, bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I finally cheers. Remembered. Cheers, babe.
Nice job.
Mwah. Clink. Clink.
So good.
Yum.
Hits you faster when it's warm, I feel like.
I feel the same. Yeah, I feel the same.
Feels good. So many despondent prospectors who had accepted defeat were now embarking on the return journey, and these men carried the news that there was not enough food in Dawson to last through the winter, and the whole of the gold mining area was already staked out. Thus, London's team elected to make camp and prospect within the vicinity. Little gold was unearthed by London or the rest of his group, yet London discovered a wealth of community among these prospectors. Like the locals in the region who London observed sharing, quote, both poverty and wealth, the prospectors developed a, quote, community conscience and worked together owing to the, quote, sheer necessities of frontier life, which tended to erode the individualism of these self-driven men. Not only did the miners rely upon one another in facing the many dangers and toils of life in the Yukon, but they also shared in whatever profits and pleasures they managed to come by. Participating in a festive communal consumption of wealth, every time one miner struck gold, London developed a rich conception of communal living and camaraderie during this period of his life. So I really like that. Just like being a sailor, mm-hmm. you know, as soon as you come back from your voyage, you have all this money that you made and you just spend it at the bars. It's like these guys just like, oh, I struck it rich and now I'm just buying things for everyone in my camp. You
I
know?
Love that. Like, that kind of camaraderie is just so fucking fantastic.
Yeah, totally. And I think it really informed his socialism, too. It's not just what I made. It's what we share in the benefits. You know, when one person does well, we all share, you know, like,
yeah,
I really love that. So even though there was a lot of camaraderie, there was much solitude in the Klondike. And London used a significant portion of this time to reflect upon his past and contemplate his future. Later in life, he often repeated the words, "It was in the Klondike that I found myself. There, nobody talks. Everybody thinks. You get your perspective. I got mine."
Neat. That's a cool quote.
I know. I like, it makes me want to go be solitary somewhere out in the wild.
It doesn't make me want to do that, but.
No.
But I totally fucking respect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I bet a younger Hillary would have been all about it, but like, I'm just like, I'm going to fucking sweatpants it up on my couch.
Yeah, and be with the ones you love, you know?
Yeah, that's probably more what it is.
I don't know. Not everyone is built for this kind of a fucking life. It's crazy.
I mean, I'm not.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Not many people are, you know.
He's a fucking badass, though. I have mad respect.
I know. Insane respect for this dude.
Yeah.
So one aspect of life in the primitive reaches of the Yukon was particularly unpalatable to London. He had none of the sweets that he craved.
Oh, that would be a deal breaker for me, man.
There you go. He's like, fuck this. I'm going home.
We found it.
Sour Patch Kids.
No, not Sour Patch Kids. Probably like,
what do you want?
Brownies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Such the a chocolatey
sweet seas.
Yeah. Such a sucker for that.
Yeah. That's more my jam. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Chocolate
But he
cookies.
liked hard candies and shit like that. And then he couldn't even eat them later in life because his teeth were so shitty. So.
Oh, jeez. Gnarly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bummer town, man.
Yeah. He didn't live much longer than us, so. But he also didn't brush his teeth much, so.
Well, I mean, if he had brushed his teeth.
Jack, you should have done that.
Should have brushed your teeth, Jackie.
Jackie, that's such a demeaning nickname.
I know,
for
that's
a boy.
So bad. Sorry.
I kind of like it, though. I feel like I would call my son Jack Jackie.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm that asshole parent that calls my kid like 50,000 different names besides his name. So.
Whatever suits you, really.
Yeah.
It's more fun that way.
Totally. What about Jacko?
Jacko. Lantern.
No.
Like that.
No.
Jacko.
Jackarino.
Like that.
Anyways. Sorry.
Anyways.
So random.
Nickname tangent.
I know. I like it, though.
I wonder what his nicknames were.
I know. Now I'm curious.
I know that he had some with his second wife, Charmian.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't remember what they were. So furthermore, his diet was incredibly limited up in the Klondike. So limited that it affected his physical health in a drastic way. Surviving off bacon, bread, and beans, London began to notice his gums bleeding and his teeth loosening.
Ooh.
While suffering from intense joint pain, exhaustion, and general anguish. Had he chosen to remain in the Klondike, his scurvy would have rapidly killed him. After this experience, London's confidence in his Nietzschean superhuman status was greatly shaken. Nietzsche is all about physical strength being a virtue. And he says that the advent of Catholicism and, you know, worshiping the meek and the weak turned people away from valuing strength as the main value system.
Right, right.
And so then, and yeah, completely like inverted the natural, normal value system. Jack London's really into this Nietzschean strongman concept.
Interesting.
Which I also really like, even though it lends itself to some other ugly philosophies like Nazism.
Oh, hard pass.
Yeah. Now Nietzsche wasn't a Nazi, but the Nazis loved to take his shit and
spin it.
And,
yeah,
use it for their own. So this reality solidified his conviction that he could not indefinitely rely upon his physical strength to garner a living. Sick in an abandoned Alaska commercial company cabin, he scrawled, "Jack London, miner, author." January 27th, 1898, on the log beside his bunk. It seems that London had now fully resolved to make a writer of himself regardless of how hard he would have to work for it. This work offered the hope of a life free from the hard labor that was already steadily consuming his body, a life that would free him from the predatory jaws of the economic masters of society. London lingered in the Klondike for the entirety of the winter till his health demanded that he return to civilization. While he might have otherwise remained to continue his search for gold a while longer, he was now in desperate need of fresh fruits and vegetables to remedy his worsening scurvy. It was the necessity of becoming a breadwinner that drove London to expend a year of his life in the Klondike, and it was the necessity of acquiring food unavailable in the Klondike that drove him back to California. His life hung on a thread owing to the lack of a diverse diet in this hostile environment, and London's awareness of how urgently he needed fresh produce certainly deepened his understanding of the horrors of scarcity. News of his stepfather's death only strengthened Jack's determination to return home, where he could work to support his mother and his stepsister's son, who was now being raised by Flora, his mother. Upon his return to Oakland, London searched desperately for a job, registering at 5 employment agencies and offering his diverse services in the newspapers while simultaneously pouring every extra hour into his writing. Despite his willingness to take any work offered, jobs were so scarce that he found nothing, and was therefore driven to funnel all of his energies into attempting to publish for money. Again, he submitted short stories, poems, and essays to countless magazines, keeping meticulous records of submissions and rejections, the latter of which remained all that he received in return for his work. Roland Phillips, an associate editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, wrote a letter to London in which he explained that his submission had been rejected on the grounds that there was, quote, too much meat in it for our 500,000 lady readers.
I'm sorry, too much what?
He said there's too much meat
ridiculous.
In it.
Ridiculous.
So, violent descriptions of fights between men and bloody images of meat consumption were considered distasteful and unsuitable for the primarily middle and upper class audience of the time.
God, that is such a dated view.
Like, I know!
Oh my God, of course, like, that would be the thing, right? Like, such a about meat shit too much. Understanding of women. Like,
yeah, totally.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a man that fucking did that too. Like, you know it was a man that was like, nah, our lady friends can't handle this. It's like, excuse you, you're wrong.
And I bet there were a bunch of ladies out there who would have been like all fucking about it.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Like,
there were some badass women authors that were, you know, I probably would have eaten the shit up, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Female authors like Emily Bronte,
yes,
who like just like dark and weird and twisted. Yeah. There are tons of women that would have been down.
But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, but that just like antiquated view of women being this like gentle, fragile being. Like, no, yeah. that's not it, guys.
I know. I feel like we're still battling with that image of women are so much more badass than that.
Yeah,
you know?
I feel like I actually would disagree with you. I think that it's pretty much been shattered. Like, I think
awesome.
That like when it comes to like, you know, like advertising and Hollywood and all that crap, it's still very strong there. But I think just in like real life, like there is no like pressure, like just among humans, like, I don't know. I could be totally fucking wrong about that. My opinion is just clouded in the fact that, like, you know, my social circles don't hold that. But, like, you know, I don't know.
I think that's definitely a part of it. And I think you're also just a strong person that doesn't care about those fucking norms. And so doesn't feel like you have to abide by them.
Yeah. Like, maybe that's it.
Some people, like, I mean, I remember the just like, oh, I'm not being proper. I'm not being like ladylike.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think, I hope that you're right. That
I mean, I hope so. Moved past I that. Hope so. Yeah. I don't know. I'm probably fucking wrong.
I think, yeah. I mean,
but
it's so
at least I'm hopeful and I don't fucking know.
And you're also one of those women that isn't like that, just like me. We're not very prim and proper on this podcast.
No, not at all. No. I definitely, yeah. I would not describe myself as neither prim nor proper.
No, I would not describe you that way either. No, these are not some of the top words that come to mind.
No.
Wild and hilarious and independent and those are some of the first ones that come to mind.
Thanks, babe.
But yeah, I mean, it's a weird little peering into the past where, oh, authors can't
talking
read this
about
shit.
Meat. Like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. I don't know, all of a sudden I thought about our friend's son who
I already know what story you're going to tell. You absolutely have to.
Can
tell
you
it.
Tell it then? You tell it.
I'll totally tell it.
Yeah.
So our friend is really, really great about like, you know, creating boundaries with like foul language and stuff. And so he's not allowed to cuss at certain times. And so like, he can like ask for permission, you know, when he can cuss. And he was really upset about something and he goes, Mom, Dad, I'm really angry. I just want to say the F word. I don't remember exactly how he asked or whatever. But they're like, yeah, okay, no, this is a great time. Like, you have, it's totally okay. You have our permission. And he goes, fucking meat. He just like couldn't think of like another thing to say because he was just so wound up and like pissed off about something. And it's just like the perfect little example. Perfect little thing. Like, it was just hilarious. And now I often find myself saying, like, fucking meat. Because it's so perfect. Like, yeah.
I mean, maybe he's tapping into the same thing that, you know, if it's forbidden in this zone and he thinks it's a forbidden thing to say.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Totally, totally.
So funny.
He's so, you know, wise beyond his years.
Yeah. Love that kid.
Yeah, I do too. He's the fucking best.
Oh, speaking of kids, I feel like
Yeah, my wild child is screaming in his own little, like, primitive
mini caveman way.
Yep, totally.
So we were talking about, yeah, his depictions of meat in literature and how that was a reason to not publish him. So Mabel Applegarth, whose affection and approval London hungered for, discouraged his writing efforts and urged him to take a job with the U.S. Post Office. Still, London rejected the advice he received from Mabel and others, who told him to quit his attempts at writing and continue to seek steady employment. In a letter to Mabel, London wrote, "If I had followed what my sister would have advised," what she was advising as well, "I would today be a clerk for $40 a month, a railroad man, or something similar. I would have a full stomach, a warm body, no qualms of conscience, no bitterness of heart, no worrying ambition, no aim but to buy furniture on the installment plan and marry. I would be satisfied to live a puppet and die a puppet."
Oh my God.
Yeah. He's like, that's not the life for me.
Yeah, I guess not, huh?
No. So for London, it was not enough to simply fill his belly. He must also escape his enslavement to the capitalist predators that had been eating him alive. He had to become his own master. London described himself as a hungry writer during this point in his life. "According to London, during this time, everything I possessed was in pawn, and I did not have enough to eat. I was sick mentally and physically from lack of nourishment. I was at the end of my tether, beaten out, starved, ready to go back to coal shoveling or ahead to suicide. A visiting friend found it necessary to stay until assured that London would not seriously hurt himself during this hopeless period."
Golly, it's just really tough.
Yeah. And this is like someone that has so many skills that can't get a job, who's so fucking talented at everything he does, and the market's just so bad that he can't find anything.
Yeah.
So having failed to have all but one short story entitled To the Man on the Trail published for a minuscule $5, an increasingly depressed London resigned himself to a future as a mail carrier. Surprisingly, it was his mother, Flora, who tipped the balance in favor of London's persisting in his efforts as a writer, rather than taking the job offered by the post office. At this bleak crossroads, the mother who had denied London love and affection became his greatest source of support. It was shortly after London passed up the post office position that his writings began to find their way into the magazines.
Nice.
Yeah. Between 1900 and his early death at age 40 in 1916, London became a world-famous author and the most widely read writer of his time. Everywhere around the globe.
That's like translated. So insane.
Yeah.
I wish it had happened earlier for him, though. I really wish.
But I also, like, all of the things that he went through to get to that point informed him so much, made him so much more conscious about other people's struggles.
That's true. That's true.
Made him think about other people in,
and really fueled what he wrote and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, totally. That's true. I mean, he's like, oh, you know, I came back poor from the Klondike, but I had this wealth of knowledge of the world and experience that I could then, you know,
that's like, viable.
Yeah, he gained so much, even though he was being broken by all of these phases of his life.
Yeah, physically and mentally broken.
Yeah, but also formed and shaped in the right direction that he needed to go. So
yeah.
So over the course of these 16 years, London would write 1,000 words every day, and he sold every work he produced. Even after achieving literary fame, London still conceived of his work as a means of acquiring food. In a letter to his Russian socialist friend and love interest, Anna Strunsky, London remarked, "Henceforth, I shall dream romances for other people and transmute them into bread and butter."
Wait, is that a different gal from his first hit piece or what?
First hit piece. This is, this is, she... Mabel Applegarth is like the one that he kind of fell in love with, but then he hasn't married yet, he has this kind of love affair with the socialist woman who is, she's like not very striking looking, but really, really fucking smart. And he's like blown away by her, and he's like head over heels. And they did some collaboration and wrote some like love poems or something like that together. They published some stuff.
Yeah.
Some fucking like, that's like, yeah, so weird.
What a slut. I like your words. Yeah. You want to do it?
Exactly. I think that's pretty much how it went down for them.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I'm gathering.
I don't know if they actually ever made love, but... But it was definitely...
Some like saucy letters back and forth.
Yeah, I think so. Really saucy. I'm pretty sure that's how it went.
Nice.
So... for London, the driving force behind his struggle to elevate both his class standing and his mind was the hunger he wished to escape. The failure of his capitalist society to satisfy this basic physiological necessity, despite his endless hours of toil within numerous occupations, compelled London toward a higher form of labor that engaged and cultivated the immaterial intellectual facets of his being. Furthermore, this base desire to eat rather than being eaten by the profit-hungry capitalists drove London toward the kinds of theories that would allow him to understand and find solutions to the problematic societal structures that had deprived him of the material necessities of life and the higher forms of self-actualization he desired. The miserably base material existence into which London was forced under capitalism therefore served as a catalyst for his higher quests in the form of his writing and his socialism. While these pursuits expressed London's desire to transcend his enslavement to biological necessity, in another respect, the base call of the stomach can be understood as a force that was deeply enlightening and transformative for Jack London. This force led him to adopt a philosophically materialist perspective similar to that of Marx and Feuerbach. Feuerbach was a theorist who heavily influenced Marx and who famously asserted that, quote, "Man is what he eats." Not only was London's mental and physical constitution determined by what he ate, but it was also determined by what he was unable to eat. Thus, for London, the belly need was not simply an influence that he wished to transcend. It was also a need that he strove to satisfy, and through his strivings, he underwent a transformation that allowed him to comprehend and attempt to transform the material world around him. So kind of like what we were just saying, like,
yeah,
he kind of had to go through these dark things, you know,
right,
to get to where he got to. Mm-hmm. But so London evolved into a devout socialist, writing and lecturing at length about the topic. He played a role in the creation of the Intercollegiate Socialist Society along with Upton Sinclair.
I didn't realize Upton Sinclair was socialist.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
I mean, yeah, interesting.
I haven't read much of his writing, but I know that I'm going to be so into it.
Yeah, you
know?
I bet.
Yeah. I mean, I know his work. I know his body of work. But yeah, I mean, that's something, a glaring blank spot in my knowledge.
Yeah, so, totally.
But I know he's fucking rad. So London also embarked upon a transcontinental lecture tour during which he delivered his incendiary essay and speech entitled Revolution to college students and elite clubs composed of some of the wealthiest Americans. He's talking to the wealthiest Americans about the revolution.
What the fuck? How much would you give to be a fly on the wall?
Oh my God. Seriously, dude. Just like... watching people's reactions to shit would just make my fucking life. Like, what is this guy saying right now? Oh my God. I came here to see this famous author and he's telling me how I'm going to be overthrown by people.
Oh,
like,
my
what?
God. Yeah. Intense. So, yeah. You could probably just feel the collective butthole pucker from everyone. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. What am I doing here? Why did I come here? Oh, shit. I love that the butthole pucker has become the, like, epitome of, like, horrible anticipation.
Horrible. Yeah, it's like, bleh.
Yeah. So during the speech, The Revolution, He spoke of the coming revolution in which the predatory economic masters of society would be overthrown and their property redistributed, an announcement that led his audience to either exalt or vilify the eloquent socialist. Owing to the radical nature of his message, his books were banned from libraries across the country.
Of course.
Yep, yep.
Good Lord.
And his social, yeah. And his social writings were relegated to the margins of American literature. So I really think that we don't think of Jack London as an author for adults. And it's just an author that writes about animals for kids because of his socialism.
Yeah. That's how I was introduced to him in high school.
Yeah.
So I think totally. You're right about that.
When he has so much substance to everything that he writes, and it's so just like, it's so penetrating, everything, every topic that he takes on, he just like speaks directly to you. Yeah. I think that's like was viewed as a threat widely in America and not in other countries as much. In other countries, he was more like warmly received all of his writing.
Yeah.
But in America, it's like White Fang and Call of the Wild.
Yep.
That's Jack London.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And To Build a Fire. All of which is fucking amazing and so dope, but like his other shit is so amazing, and if you haven't had any exposure to it, I recommend that everyone try to read a little bit more of his works, because
yeah, you spouted off a few titles in the last episode. Spout some more, tell people what they should be grabbing. Don't go to Amazon, guys. Find some find your local bookstore. Get to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it on hand, have them order it for you and then pick it up and support your local bookstore.
I fucking love that, dude. I love that so much. There's also Alibri is this app that I downloaded that they go to all these local bookstores and they buy the books from the bookstores and then ship
fantastic.
Them to you.
Fantastic. Awesome. That's another great solution.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So that's something that I was like really excited about. It took a little longer than ordering from Amazon, but Amazon.
Like accept that. Like,
yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally.
I mean, and so we're literally talking like a few more days, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
And the whole excuse of like, well, I don't want to pay for shipping. Well, then don't fucking spout about like how you like want to support small business, but then don't support small business by paying for their shipping. Come on, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get with it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I love that, Hillary.
Mom lecture is over. Mom lecture is over.
No, this podcast has really been helping me to like more consistently avoid Amazon and just fucking go for the better options. Cause I'm like, nope. I want my money to speak. You know, I want my money to.
Yep.
You sent me a post that was really great about like,
consumer activism.
Yeah, that's the word. Yes.
Yeah, so supporting businesses that more so align with your views and choosing not to support businesses that don't align with your views. So, giving high five. That was really cute, Erica. Erica just gave me a high five over our video screen. It was adorable.
I love it though.
No, but like I think that that's a practice that like should absolutely be more in place by literally everyone. Like
totally.
You can vote with your dollar. Like you can choose to be a little bit more patient and purchase from like smaller businesses online or local businesses, like toddle on down to your local bookstore owned by a local person and give them their money, and like I said, like if they don't have the book, like they can order it,
totally.
And just be patient, because it's worth not fucking lining Jeff Bezos fucking fatty McFat fat fucking wallet more than it is. Like it's worth it, y'all.
Come on. And it's like with your money, you're breathing life into whatever you're paying for. You're breathing life into, you're like saying, I will this thing to be in existence. I will this bookstore that's a small little independent bookstore to be in existence.
Yeah.
I don't will Amazon to be taking all of our money and,
Yeah, totally.
It's
so convenient. It's just like, well, there's actually other convenient avenues as well. You just got to take like just a little teensy weensy bit more time to find those avenues. Like I have found other avenues or other shops or whatever that offer free shipping or offer expedited shipping or whatever, like all of that stuff. Like
totally.
Yeah. Just That's a long rant. I better stop myself.
I am so all about that rant, and I love that you brought that up, especially when we're like talking about like the cold and heartless like publishing companies that he was dealing with, and
totally,
like,
yeah,
you know, like the kind of industry around writing and around books, and like,
oh, you know, it's a crapshoot. It's horrible.
And like, it's really tough. What are you propping up, and what are you, you know, what are you tearing down with your money? Because really giving it to Amazon is killing all those other bookstores. So.
Yeah.
So we were talking about London socialism and his socialist writings. London even ran for mayor of Oakland in 1901 as the Socialist Party candidate.
Nice.
Yeah. Through his socialism, London generalized the lessons instilled by the hunger of his youth. He indicted the capitalist master class for its complete mismanagement of society, declaring that, quote, capitalist society forfeits its right to existence by permitting bestial poverty and starvation despite its possession of the enormous wealth with which it could eradicate these societal ills. So I really love that. So in Wanted, A New Law of Development, London illuminates the direct connection between his socialism and his views on hunger and food. Why should there be one empty belly in all the world when the work of 10 men can feed 100? What if my brother be not so strong as I? He has not sinned. Wherefore should he hunger? He and his sinless little ones. Down with the old law. There is food and shelter for all. Therefore, let all receive food and shelter.
I think those are such valid points and things that like kind of hit me hard right now, because I just keep thinking about like the homeless and the increasing homeless population and like all of the people facing evictions here really soon. Like,
absolutely.
It's so tough. Like, the work of 10 men can feed hundreds. Like, that's a very powerful quote, mostly because it's fucking true.
Yeah, it's so fucking true. And automation is making it so that you could automate away so many jobs and produce so much food for less cost, less labor, you know, but it's the capitalists that own those technologies, and they just use those to increase their profits instead of to distribute more widely, you know? So that quote really hit me really hard too. And it was one of the main reasons why Jack London really shaped some of my views too, you know?
Yeah.
Did you want to add anything else there?
I do. I have a thought, but it's not fully formed.
Oh, well, go for it. We can cut it.
Okay. Yeah. It just makes me like really kind of wonder why there aren't more aspects of the food industry, whether it be restaurants or grocery stores or what have you, that don't adjust or adopt certain ways that turn food waste into ways to like feed people in need.
Yeah.
Like, and absolutely. I don't know what that looks like. I'm not even going to try and act as if I know what that looks like, but I just know that we do have a food waste problem in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And
we have a hunger problem. Bothers me.
Yeah. And we have a hunger problem, and like those two should not coexist.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that same problem so much of the time, where it's just like, it's just a logistics thing, you know, like just get the thing from over here and put it over here and create a better system for doing that, because this is just not, it's just wasteful.
And I think, like, you know, I'm not like, you know, trying to take profits away from individuals, like I really am just kind of thinking like, you're gonna put that food in the garbage anyways.
Exactly.
Like, please don't put it in the garbage. Please just find a system to put in place that gets that food to hungry bellies.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like, but at any rate.
I think there are, and we really should, I think we mentioned it even before, there's like apps and things where there are people that are trying to solve that problem. And I think this is definitely material that we're going to go into. One of us is going to go into for sure.
Yeah, you know? totally.
At some point, we're going to tackle it. So.
Yeah.
I wonder if we'll ever have the same topic that we choose independently.
Oh, man.
And then be like,
oh, you bitch. I was going to do that.
I think it would be good, though, because I feel like we would do our own research, but we'd come, like, we'd have the same central facts and then, like, have our own angles, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I think
it could be good. Potential future
food things. For thought, Erica.
Yeah, food. Totally. So we talk about, okay, there's food and shelter for all, therefore let all receive food and shelter. That was his quote from Wanted, A New Law of Development. I just remember that you were like, oh, what are those other sources that people should read? And I didn't really answer that.
Oh, yeah. I was asking, what other Jack London books people should read, because I do feel like the only titles that people are really exposed to are like the two in high school, you know?
Yeah. So, The Call of the Wild and the yes. and White Fang.
Yeah. I mean, I've literally only read The Call of the Wild.
That was yeah.
it. We were encouraged to read White Fang, but that was, yeah. wasn't required. So I didn't read it.
Oh, it's so good. You would love it. You would totally love it so much. Oh my God. The depiction of White Fang and her cubs, you would feel for all of these creatures so much. He's so good at really, really depicting in a really vivid, like where you can intimately understand these animals' lives. Yeah. Like, he's so good at that.
Awesome.
Yeah. But I love The Sea Wolf is another incredible one that he wrote.
Nice.
And it deals with some more of his like Nietzschean philosophy. And that one was really, really beautifully done. I love all of his short stories. I love The People of the Abyss.
Ooh, I'm a short story girl. I might have to pick best short stories.
Yeah, totally. I was just thinking how I need to buy you a collection of some of his short stories, and including like Love of Life, that one that I talked about before.
Yeah. Yes.
That one's definitely my favorite. But yeah, he wrote so much in his short life, and there's so much out there to choose from, and it is every single thing that I've read of his I love, so it's
been meaning to read more of his stuff. I'm like, yeah, and it would be a nice break from like the parenting books that I'm reading.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm hesitant to throw more books your way because you've got so much on your plate. So
and now do it.
Cool. I will. London committed himself to mastering the masters of society through both wide-scale revolution and within his own life. Rather than existing as famished prey for the economic predators, London became a wealthy capitalist. Rather than watching his wealthy human beings starve and suffer enslavement by the class to which he now belonged, London became an impassioned and outspoken socialist.
Yeah.
So although London's odd pairing of capitalistic strivings and ideological devotion to socialism may seem utterly contradictory or hypocritical, the material conditions I've outlined pertaining to eating and his evolution into an author may help to reconcile or at least account for the simultaneous coexistence of such opposing tendencies within Jack London.
I mean, I don't know that it's hypocritical. I think it's just that, there's a system in place. It doesn't allow for the other system. And mm-hmm. when he believes in one system over the other,
Yeah. I think it's possible to want to do well in your existing system, want to like thrive with the world that you live in, but also try to advocate for a different world, It's like, you're not supposed to just like want to be in complete poverty and dying, to be a socialist. Yeah. A lot of people have the misconception that you have to be like totally poor and broke and fucking, just like completely writing off any kind of survival mechanisms in capitalism. No, you have to fucking live. So,
Sorry, that's my kiddo in the background.
Oh, no worries. I love his little cry.
I don't know if it's crying more so belly aching. He's totally belly aching right now.
You know the sounds well.
Yeah, I know that he's grilling up some steaks right now, so he's really just crying out for some meat.
Nice, dude.
He's like, gimme.
That's probably it. So while London made money like a capitalist, he fully rejected the capitalistic injunction to accumulate, distributing his wealth among friends and loved ones who would later depict London as generous almost to a fault. His willingness to part with his wealth was doubtlessly trained through his experiences of communal distribution and consumption. Immersion in both mining culture and sailor culture involved long periods of toil amongst isolated communities of men who would celebrate payday, striking gold or returning from a raid or voyage by collectively expending their wealth in festive alcohol-soaked binges.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah.
Lordy.
That's the culture. And indeed. I like it. I really like it. Give it when you have it. So after acquiring some literary recognition for The Man on Trail and other short stories depicting life in the Klondike, London married his first wife, Elizabeth Bess Mattern.
Oh, he settled down, huh?
Oh, not really. Not really. Just really short. And he moved to the Piedmont Hills. Soon after, he left on a six-week journalistic voyage to the East End of London, where he witnessed the dire poverty that inspired his novel titled The People of the Abyss. In it, he writes that, quote, "Nowhere in the streets of London may one escape the sight of abject poverty, while 5 minutes' walk from almost any point will bring one to a slum. We rolled along through miles of brick and squalor, and from each cross street and alley flashed long vistas of bricks and misery. Here and there lurched a drunken man or woman, and the air was obscene with sounds of jangling and squabbling. At market, tottery old men and women were searching in the garbage thrown in the mud for rotten potatoes, beans, and vegetables, while little children clustered like flies around a festering mass of fruit, thrusting their arms to the shoulders into the liquid corruption, and drawing forth morsels but partially decayed, which they devoured on the spot." And that really reminds me of what you just brought up, like the waste food and the hungry people at the same time.
Yeah, it shouldn't fucking exist.
No, yeah. We're more advanced as a species than that, you know?
Yeah,
we totally. Should fucking be, at least.
Totally.
So after the birth of his two daughters in 1901 and 1902, London published The Call of the Wild, a work that immediately made him famous.
Nice.
Yeah. Yay, finally.
Yeah.
So for a brief period in 1904, London became a war correspondent for William Randolph Hearst's newspaper.
Awesome.
Traveling to Japan and Korea to report on the raging Russo-Japanese War. So expecting a direct experience of the violence of war, London was dismayed when the authorities in these countries denied him any access to the war front. London returned to California to the joys and stresses of his relationships. Having already fallen in love with Charmian Kittredge, whose bold personality contrasted starkly with his wife's conservative demeanor, London chose to separate from Bess and marry Charmian in 1905.
Oh, goodness. There it is.
Yeah, right after. Right after pumping out two kids.
Jesus.
Yeah,
I mean, kind of fucked up, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that I struggle with about Jack London is, like, his approach to relationships. I mean, he was quite in love with his second wife, Charmian, and they had a great understanding, but she almost, like, covered for him in all of his wild undertakings and all of his infidelity and everything. She was just, like, such a supporter, and she knew that he was this wild, out of this world, bit larger than life dude, and she just was like, that's him, you know?
Like, yeah, just accepting her partner. That's a powerful woman.
Oh my God, yeah. She was a pretty awesome badass. There's a lot of pictures of her in these, like, really cool poses on their, like, on their ship that they were sailing around the Pacific in. Back in those days, her not being prim and proper and in the, you know, right attire and everything was, like,
right.
a scandal, you know? So
yeah, right.
So she's, like, the scandalous, like, uncouth, weird, you know, woman.
Undone hair, messy dress, all that crap.
She wants to read stories about meat.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. While she's nomming on a steak.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Totally.
So, late in his short life, London's concern for the hungry masses and his near obsession with eating manifested in a radically different undertaking. And you're going to like this. America's rapidly growing population, paired with the ruinous state of agriculture throughout the country, yielded a situation in which the food supply of the nation was under threat. By this point, London had grown tired of cities and city people. Thus, he and his wife Charmian purchased 150 acres near Glen Ellen, California. Their move took place at a time when the Country Life Movement, or Back to the Country Movement, was in full swing around the U.S. amongst agrarian-minded urbanites seeking to escape the economic mastery of landlords and industrial corporations by transitioning to the rural farm life they romanticized. So does that sound familiar at all?
A little bit.
This is happening right now again in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I can name several people who have done so.
Yeah, this back and forth between like, oh, we want to move to the cities and we like this life, but we actually like the agrarian life where you're raising your own food and stuff is you're getting more back to the basics and there's that pull that's happening right now for so many people in my life and
a lot of people.
Yeah, including myself. Like, I want to get away from the city and do this. So
yes, yeah. Yes.
So London gradually acquired the surrounding land before converting the estate into his flourishing 1,300-acre beauty ranch. So this dramatic shift in London's life and labor amounted to a complete 180-degree turn in London's sentiment regarding an agrarian lifestyle. As a child, he had scorned the monotony of farm labor on his stepfather's many farms. Now, London seized upon his agricultural undertakings with a passion. Writing to Eliza Shepherd, the stepsister whom he had hired to manage the ranch, London stated that his primary objective was to grow food, while the second objective was profit. Profit both with regard to financial returns and improvements in the richness of the soil.
Nice.
Yeah. In this undertaking, London faced one looming obstacle, the rapid rise of large-scale monocrop bonanza farms.
Fuck.
Your episode, dude.
Uh-huh.
I feel like God we've hit so many of our episodes just in this episode of his
totally.
Life.
Totally. Yeah. God. But like not in a positive way.
Yeah, like in like, a,
in
problems-
like a fucking bummer. God damn it. This is such a fucking glaring problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is like over 120 years ago, and it's still the same thing.
Yeah, well, these aren't new problems. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's like kind of frustrating, actually.
It's really frustrating. It's like, But it also makes me think that like, well, you know, we've been dealing with this for a while. Maybe we can come up with something, a better solution. Maybe there's a way out of this same problem that we've been
facing.
I have hope.
Yeah. I have hope.
That's why we're doing the kind of shit that we're doing. So
exactly.
Exactly. the rapid rise of large-scale monocrop bonanza farms around the time of London's birth had utilized improvements in agriculture technology and a factory-style business model that quickly exhausted the nation's soil.
Yeah.
Gilded Age wheat moguls such as Hugh James Glenn made their fortunes by utilizing cheap sources of immigrant labor and devastating massive swaths of farmland, plundering the earth in a fashion very similar to that of the Bonanza gold miners.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Norris's novel entitled The Octopus describes this pillaging of the earth by Bonanza wheat moguls while highlighting conflicts between the monopolistic industrial railroad trust and the farmers. London wrote a glowing review of this work of literary naturalism that went on to address similar issues in novels informed by his experience as a rancher, novels such as The Little Lady of the Big House and The Valley of the Moon. Those are
nice.
Books. Yeah, so he's writing about these exact issues in novels as well. I haven't read both of those in their entirety, but just parts of them. So,
ooh, let's read them together.
I know. It was like low on my list just because it was more of the domestic, less of the wild stuff that I was really into. But I also like,
yeah,
this is
you
the
want
direction.
The meat.
I want the meat. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I want the meat. Yeah, I'm nothing like those women that they were trying to.
No,
do the magazine
absolutely
for.
Nothing. Yeah. Nope.
Or their idea of a woman that didn't actually exist. But
totally, totally, totally. You badass.
I try.
As you say, I think the most like least badass way. I love it. It's fucking great.
I mean, I don't feel like such a badass, but
what? Wow, you're so fucking wrong. Oh my God.
Aw, that's really nice. Dude, thank you. Preach.
Appreciate you, motherfucker.
Exactly. So, Speaking of his initial attempt at raising hay for his horses, London asserted that I could scarcely get the seed back. The soil had been worn out. It had been farmed for years by old-fashioned methods of taking everything off and putting nothing back. London was very aware that the prior owners of his land had depleted the nutrient-rich soil with short-sighted farming practices. To this personal dilemma, which had also become a blight on the nation and its food supply, London applied the agricultural wisdom he had acquired during his travels abroad as a sailor and as a war correspondent, as well as the knowledge he continuously obtained through his extensive study of works such as F. H. King's Farmers of 40 Centuries of Permanent Agriculture in China, Korea, and Japan. In a letter to Geddes Smith, an editor for The Independent and Countryside magazine, London describes his objectives with regard to his farming operation. In a few words, I am trying to do what the Chinese have done for 40 centuries, namely to farm without commercial fertilizer. I am rebuilding worn-out hillside lands that were worked out and destroyed by our wasteful California pioneer farmers. I am not using commercial fertilizer. I believe the soil is our one indestructible asset, and by green manures, nitrogen-gathering cover crops, rotation of crops, proper tillage and drainage, I am getting results which the Chinese have demonstrated for 40 centuries.
Dude, that is fucking fantastic. I love that so hard. It's so rad.
It's like...
I'm just over here like eating this up like, oh man, so cool.
It's like exactly what you were talking about. All the problems. And he's like, I'm on it. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
And like...
That's fucking cool.
And reading both science and the like ancient wisdom.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah. Because like you don't want to discount what people have been doing for centuries that has worked and been good for the earth. And they figured out how to do it sustainably. And you also don't want to discount modern science and what they've figured out that's even better. You know, like.
Yeah. Marrying the two is going to yield the best result. That's so fucking cool.
Fuck yeah. I know.
So good.
I was just getting into farming and stuff when I was doing this research on Jack London. And I was like, oh my God, he did all the
so
things.
Rad. Yeah. All the things that I want to do.
Exactly. All the issues that I'm worried about too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after consulting both scientific literature of his day and the tried and true methods of sustainable farming in other countries, London decided to terrace the rolling hills that made up his property so as to retain moisture and prevent nutrients from being leached out of the soil. In addition, he adopted a policy of taking nothing off the ranch, raising the food for his livestock and utilizing the first manure spreader in the region in order to, quote, put the fertilizer back on the land before its strength was leached out. By adopting these methods of feeding the starved soil, London was able to avoid the use of artificial fertilizers, blazing the trail.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. He fucking did it. And this is so long ago, you know?
It's so great.
Yeah, this is, and what I was just going to say, this is blazing the trail with regard to organic farming long before the demand for organic produce had ever even emerged.
That's way ahead of his time.
Yeah. No one was talking about this shit then, you know?
No, but he was on it.
Yeah. He just knew, like, this is the way that we need to start thinking and acting and eating.
Very cool. Uh-huh. Yeah, and he's right.
He's fucking right. So his progressive methods of farming proved fruitful. His ranch produced fields of oats, barley, grapes, berries, pears, apples, avocados, and plums.
Yum.
Mm-hmm. In addition, he raised award-winning livestock that were closely monitored and cared for. His horses, pigs, goats, sheep, and beef and dairy cattle were considered the best bred in the county. And he actually was, like, winning awards. He wasn't breeding them to slaughter them. He was breeding them to be good stock for breeding. So he's
I can imagine that he had, like, this just, like, really sweet, gentle way of, like, raising these animals as well.
Mm-hmm. London extended his ecologically conscious stewardship of Beauty Ranch to both the land and its animal inhabitants. The love he had felt for animals during his childhood had only increased by the time he started ranching, and thus he ensured that all of the livestock on his ranch were well fed and treated with the utmost care. Just
nice.
Like he started.
Yeah.
Yeah. His pigs, which were sold to breeders rather than butchers, resided in what came to be known as the Pig Palace.
See, like, That just makes so much sense because of just like how he talks about animals and like how much passion he does have for like animal and
yeah
and animal nature and all that stuff, like in his work, like you just know that he was going to be that compassionate farmer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
he's thinking from the animal's perspective about what they
need. Right. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So the Pig Palace, designed by London himself, this circular stone structure, which I got to visit, contains 17 pens.
Rad.
Yeah, it was so cool. So it's like this circular structure with 17 pens bordering a central feeding house.
Oh, very cool.
So this layout allowed the entire group of up to 200 pigs to be efficiently cared for by only one person.
You're going
to
put that on your land, Erica?
Maybe. Each family of pigs enjoyed its own roofed sleeping area, as well as a communal courtyard and outdoor run. London required that visitors and workers use antiseptic foot baths prior to entering the structure, a precaution that allowed London's pigs to avoid the epidemic of cholera that devastated the swine population on surrounding properties. He's just thinking ahead.
Yeah, it's really smart.
Step into that.
Cholera was a huge problem at that time.
Yeah, and just wiped out people's livestock, just completely, completely
and
destroyed.
People.
Yeah, yeah, and people. Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Yeah, it was a big problem.
So this is going back to a point that you asked me about hunting.
So,
So even the wild game that roamed the rolling hills and fields on London's estate were ethically treated. London forbade their killing.
Oh, interesting.
I know. And I was like, I had just assumed that he was a hunter, just like you were bringing up.
Yeah.
Because of this, like...
I would have assumed the same, but wow, interesting.
This is great, though. Speaking of hunting, London asserted that, "You may call it sport, if you please, to take out into the forest a machine and a belt full of cartridges and proceed to pump away at any animal you happen to see. But to me, it's no longer sport. I hate the idea of it. It would be all..."
Wow.
Yeah, I love it.
Powerful fucking words.
"It would be all very well and perfectly fair to go out with a club and kill a jackrabbit for food, but it isn't fair to take along 100 brass cartridges." I love that.
Interesting. Wow. That is wild. The way he thinks about these things is very interesting to me.
I fucking love it. And that he just says it in the most like plain terms too, you know?
Yes.
Doesn't have to use fancy words to say it.
Yeah.
Just nails it. So like I was talking about this earlier with someone that I like very much, who was talking about current fair chase rules and the fair chase kind of honor code that hunters follow, which is, it's about following game laws and not bringing like a fucking machine gun to a fucking sword fight.
Right.
But it's also just a kind of honor code that people just follow. So
that makes sense.
It's not necessarily just about the laws in whatever state. Fair chase is defined by the Boone and Crockett Club, that was founded by Theodore Roosevelt.
Awesome.
"Is the ethical, sportsmanlike, and lawful pursuit and taking of any free-ranging wild native North American big game animal in a manner that does not give the hunter an improper advantage over such animals."
Oh, wow.
I think that's
wild.
So
I didn't.
Great.
And that's in place?
Yeah, I mean.
Wow.
I mean, so many of the laws, like, you can't poison things. You can't pour poison into the ocean to kill fish and just collect them.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah. Thank God.
You can't shine your lights onto a bunch of, that's called jack lighting. You shine your light onto to deer and then they just are still and then you kill them.
Yeah.
Like things like that where it's just
I am so glad these laws are in place. That's fantastic.
Me too. I love it.
Yeah. Damn.
And I knew that things like that existed, but I didn't know the term for it. So fair chase is the term.
Interesting. Fair chase. Huh. I might have to dig more into that. That's very fascinating. I didn't know that those laws existed.
Yeah. It's so fucking important for...
It's vital. It's exceptionally important.
If you want to keep having game to hunt, you have to do it sustainably and follow the rules that make it something that can continue.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So, London's attitude towards animal life reflected his disdain for the unfair exercise of power over the powerless, highlighting his deeply ethical disdain for contests between individuals of unequal strength. The wild and domestic animals dwelling within London's ranch were treated in accordance with these socio-political views. So as with many of the lessons he acquired throughout his lifetime, London worked to offer the public those he had obtained through his agricultural research and experience. His romantic, quote, back to the country novel, entitled The Valley of the Moon, focuses on a working class couple that leaves the city and its life of wage slavery in order to become farmers in the very same countryside where London established his ranch. This novel sought to show, quote, the U.S. public how America farmed at its best and how its food supply could be secured for centuries. That's from a book by Cecilia Tichy. Written a few years later, The Little Lady of the Big House also centered upon romantic relationships, relations that develop within an agrarian setting. Protagonist Dick Forrest, an orphaned inheritor of his parents' bonanza farm fortune, delivers London's critique of devastation caused by massive-scale wheat farmers of the late 19th century. You were destructive. You were a bonanza farmer. You took 40,000 acres of the finest Sacramento Valley soil, and you grew wheat on it year after year. You never dreamed of rotation, crop rotation. You burned your straw. You exhausted your hummus. You plowed 4 inches and put a plow sole like a cement sidewalk just 4 inches below the surface. You exhausted that film of 4 inches, and now you can't get your seed back. You've destroyed. That's what my father did. Well, I'm going to take my father's money and construct. I'm going to take worked out wheat land that I can buy at a fire sale and rip out the plow sole and make it produce more in the end than it did when you fellows first farmed it. I'm going to fucking show you up.
I love that. It's so great.
Do it better than you did. Get more profit off of it, more fucking food out of it. And
badass.
Yeah, and also remedy the problems that you left. So Forrest goes on to become a progressive agriculturalist who employs the latest technological advances and scientific agricultural expertise to his massive-scale farming operation. His 250,000-acre property operates both efficiently and ethically.
I love that. Mm. Love that. Love that.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's like he's dreaming the right future for our farms, you know?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So Forrest works to preserve the health of the soil and farms entirely organically. He offers equitable profit sharing to his workers so as to prevent them from living the lives of two-legged work beasties. I love that phrase.
Love that. It's ridiculous.
Work beasties. So cute.
So cute. Jackie the Beastie.
I love it. Say that about your child too.
You can call him Jackie the Beastie. It's fine. That kid is a beast.
So Forrest offers equitable profit sharing to his workers so as to prevent them from living the lives of two-legged work beasties. His estate even contains a village with housing for the farm laborers and their families, as well as a school for their children. In these ways, his business operation can almost be described as a utopian, experimental, agrarian community. Still, Forrest is a profit-driven landowner, mastering both his employees and the capitalist economy in which he operates. Cecilia Tichy is accurate in her depiction of this character as, quote, Jack London writ large. Forrest engages in progressive agricultural experimentation in a fashion comparable to London's, but on a much grander scale. Moreover, Forrest does this in order to show up his socially and environmentally destructive capitalist predecessors, working to master the masters of society that have treated the labor power of the poor and the natural richness of the earth like resources to be exhausted and tossed aside for profit. In his final years, London turned towards the farming life from which his childhood self had wished to escape. This turn is deeply significant with regard to London's evolving relationship with hunger and food. It represents an intensification and active manifestation of London's obsession with consumption, but it also represents a concrete solution to many of the societal ills London worked to remedy during his 40 short years of life. Viewing the production and distribution of food as the most fundamental matter of society and the economy, London vehemently declared that the soil represents the very, quote, source and foundation of all economics.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Which I feel like, yeah, your episode was all about. I feel like it's just like...
Yeah, totally.
His life 100%. Underscores everything that you just underscored.
Yeah, no, that's fucking rad. I wish I had those quotes to spout during that episode, you know, because it was just right along what I was
thinking. I was thinking
saying.
About Jack London as you were doing it, and I was like, oh, this is going to come up real soon.
You held your tongue,
yeah,
huh?
I did. I didn't want to interrupt you too
nice.
Much.
Nice. You have better control than I do.
So he recognized that in order to save the working class from enslavement to the capitalist masters, it must be given access to the food for which it endlessly toiled. While the wheat moguls of the Gilded Age had produced food for profit with no regard for the hungry masses or the health of the soil they plundered, London understood that securing the present and future food supply of the nation required a very different approach toward the natural richness of the land. By listening to the needs of the soil and those that depended upon it, London engaged in a socially and environmentally conscious undertaking that was incredibly important at a time when the U.S. population was exploding and available land was rapidly diminishing. In the 21st century, humanity is presently experiencing what London referred to as the pressure of population, to a degree that far surpasses those pressures that compelled London to pioneer sustainable methods of agriculture. With multinational agrochemical and agricultural biotechnology corporations like Monsanto devastating farmland and farming communities around the world on an unprecedented scale, the need for dramatic agricultural reform is now more dire than ever. It is becoming increasingly imperative that we follow in London's footsteps with regard to agricultural experimentation, for the health of the planet and the survival of our ever-growing species depends upon global agricultural reform that prioritizes sustainability.
Yes, could not agree
yes.
more. Could not agree more. Yes.
I knew you'd be down. I knew it.
100%.
So in March of 1916, the year of his death, Jack officially resigned from the Socialist Labor Party. Huh. So in his resignation letter, London wrote that, quote, I'm resigning from the Socialist Party because of its lack of fire and fight and its loss of emphasis on the class struggle. He had often remarked that the socialist movement in America was, quote, doomed to become the bulwark of conservatism and that he felt too revolutionary to belong to the Socialist Labor Party. During an interview with the Western Comrade, London proclaimed that I still believe that the socialist...
God damn it. What up, hot toddy?
Yeah. It's the S's this time, I guess.
Dude. The S's always fucking get me so bad. It's terrible.
Well, you sounded pretty goddamn clear, and I'm appreciating that since I'm not.
It's water, man. I needed to. If I weren't drinking water right now, man.
All right. I like that when we just devolved to making fart sounds.
Yeah, pretty much. That's me regardless of how much I've had
true.
Or not
know,
had. Yeah.
So good though. That's why I love you so much.
That's why I love you so much, bitch.
Bitch.
So much. Bitch. You're the fucking best.
I'm so glad that you're like getting out of this episode what I thought you would too.
Yeah, I'm so fucking into it. So into it. Yeah. Especially all this like sustainable agriculture stuff. I'm like, yes, yes, so much.
Yay.
Yes. 100%.
You knew what was up.
Yeah, man. Smart guy.
So in an interview with the Western Comrade, London proclaimed that I still believe the socialists should strive to eliminate the capitalist class and wipe away the private ownership of mines, mills, factories, railroads, and other social needs. London signed his resignation letter the way he signed so many of his letters. Yours for the revolution, Jack London.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And you can cut this if you want. What do you think that he would think of the socialist movement today?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think he would think the same thing, that they were kind of pansies compared to like what he wanted to have happen, you know?
Yes.
But I think he didn't realize how ingrained capitalism is and how hard it is to fucking get anything to move. And I it's easy to think that tomorrow the revolution is going to happen and everything's going to be changed, but do we think it's going to be this year or the next 100 years? Or, this is more than 100 years ago that he's writing this shit and it's still the same, or we've gotten even less progressive in some ways,
Which, right.
I wonder what he would think about it. But I have a feeling that he would be disappointed that it's not achieving more. But also it's like it can't achieve more right now. Like there's not enough of America behind it,
Yeah.
At some point, maybe there will be more people that understand that, the system isn't working for them and they're too poor. But the majority of Americans love capitalism still. So it's an interesting question.
I wonder how much of it is just like fear of the unknown,
I bet a lot of it. I mean, when all of the moneyed interests are invested in keeping the system going how it's going for them, change in the unknown is like, no way.
Yeah. Especially when you have mouths to feed. I mean, Jack London ran into that issue.
Yeah, totally.
How many times did you say?
Oh my God. So many
episodes, like so much his entire life,
And which drove him to be a capitalist, drove him to make money.
Tough, man.
Super interesting point though. I'm glad you brought that up. London's swift and unexpected death at the age of 40 was shrouded in controversy. Many believe that he had deliberately overdosed on morphine owing to his growing disenchantment with the failings of humanity and a myriad other explanations. It is important to note that he had accumulated a number of ailments during his travels, including a bacterial infection called the YAWS, Y-A-W-S, that produced lesions on the skin and caused intense pain in his joints and bones.
Yikes, that's awful.
Not good. So the Jack London State Historic Park has issued a document that addresses the controversy surrounding his death. In it, they cite a press bulletin by doctors Porter, Thompson, Hayes, and Shields stating that at about 6:30 p.m. November 21st, 1916, Mr. Jack London partook of his dinner. He was taken during the night with what was supposed to be an attack of acute indigestion. This, however, proved to be a gastrointestinal type of uremia.
Oof.
Yeah. So he rapidly entered a coma and died at 7:45 p.m. November 22nd, 1916. So, citing an article by Philip Labor, MD, the park writes that, in addition to London's intake of mercury during the Snark voyage, he had this schooner that he traveled around the world with Charmian in. He went all over the place and had all these adventures with her, but he also got really sick during that trip. And then they had to go back.
Sucks, man.
So, in addition to London's intake of mercury during the Snark voyage and the possibility, which was a remedy for the YAWS, and the possibility that he suffered from systemic lupus erythematosus, there is also a real possibility that he may have suffered from both cardiovascular and cardiopulmonary disease brought on by his history of tobacco, alcohol, and poor diet. Labor suggests that London may have been afflicted with polyarticular gout due to his protein-rich diet.
Ooh, man.
Because he was eating too much protein, they say.
Yeah.
But that's crazy. Like, at least he was getting enough protein at that point, when he's been craving his whole life. But this would explain the many joint problems that afflicted him during the last 8 years of his life. The rheumatological disorders also afflicted the kidneys. The mercury and possible lupus support the claim that he had renal disease.
Whoa.
So many fucking things. London's heavy use of tobacco would have had an adverse effect on his cardiovascular and cardiopulmonary systems, as well as contributing to hypertension. Lastly, alcohol can negatively act on the cardiovascular system and also contribute to hypertension, which can cause deterioration of kidney function. Uremia can actually be made so much worse by drinking. So London asserted that the theft of meat from a girl's basket when he was a hungry boy epitomized his entire life. In the letter to Mabel Applegarth, in which he describes this incident, London continued, "Just imagine the development of my mind, my soul, under such material conditions. To understand this development, I have tried to reveal the ways that hunger fueled London's ascent to literary fame and deeply infused the thematic content of his literature. Denied his mother's milk at birth, forced to work on his stepfather's failing produce farms, and within miserable confines of factories as a child so that he and his family could eat. London's early years were marked by hunger and deprivation. His adolescence found him stealing oysters as an alternative to wage slavery, policing overfishing in the San Francisco Bay for the California Fish Patrol, a sailor hunting seals, and a tramp earning his food and money by telling convincing fictitious tales. But behind the walls of a prison, he managed a covert economy of bread and tobacco distribution among his hungry prison inmates. In many of these experiences from his adolescent years, food became a business for London, thus crystallizing an equivalency between food, money, and power within his developing mind. In the Yukon, London was forced to carry a year's supply of food on his quest for gold, and still he found himself dying for lack of certain nutriments. This experience drastically magnified London's already deep impression of the evils issuing from scarcity. These are the material conditions that solidified London's political, economic views and drove him to write despite the countless rejections he received. These are also the conditions that shaped London's disgust with a society that treated him as little more than a work beast, feeding him only enough to continue working until his body would eventually give out, digested and ejected from the bowels of a capitalist economy. Through and through, London was determined to eat and not be eaten by the masters who were preying upon and steadily consuming his physical strength. Living in perpetual flight from the jaws of these economic predators, London became a pirate capitalist, a rugged prospector, an outspoken socialist, a sustainable farmer, and a writer in possession of a wealth of experience. While his personal development was initially fueled by the call of the stomach, London strove to free humanity from a system that consumed poor laborers like fuel while barely feeding the working class enough to survive. In a very concrete sense, London's whole life and the majority of his writings can be viewed as a protest against society's inability to account for and satisfy the most basic needs of its participants. As the socialist author into which he developed, London's works evince the determination with which he strove to create a future in which, quote, man shall progress upon something worthier and higher than his stomach, when there will be a finer incentive to impel man to action than the incentive of today, which is the incentive of the stomach. And that's all.
Rad. Dude. God, these three episodes were so fucking awesome. I am so glad you did it.
Oh, awesome.
I learned so damn much. Like, so fucking cool, girl. That was fantastic.
Thank you so much. I mean, I poured a lot into that, so.
I'm so glad you did. Like, it's so fucking great.
Aww.
Such a great topic, and so much to learn there. So much to reap from these episodes. Just, like, the little bit that you offered. Like, there's so much
so
there.
Fucking much. And, like, yeah, I really feel like we hit upon, like, so many of the prior episodes we've done already. In this, like,
totally,
so many of the issues that we're worried about, homelessness and like, and sustainable agriculture and like fucking universal basic, like, you know, we didn't talk directly about universal basic income, but like indirectly, it's like about how do we solve these fucking problems that's still for after, you know, 150 years or whatever, it's still the same, you know?
Yeah. My only hope is that we aren't still talking about this in another.
I know, seriously.
Years. That's my hope.
I really hope so, too. That's a great...
My son agrees.
That's a good way to put it, because that was kind of my takeaway from all of this. It's like, whoa, we haven't moved.
We haven't budged.
Like, how... Uh-huh. I didn't have any idea that these issues were even so front and center back then, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, me neither. That was really eye-opening to me.
At least, like, getting that overview, hopefully it makes things feel like, okay, we get a glimpse into the past, we get a glimpse into the present, and like, what do we want for our future?
Yeah.
We can do this differently, you know? We don't have to keep making the same fucking mistakes, ruining our soil, or fucking, you know, leaving people out in the street when they don't need to be.
Yeah. We can... Ruining our rivers so that they're like literally on fire. Our land's on fire.
It's
our house is on fire.
Oh my God. Yep. It's fucking so true, especially for us in California. So Yeah. And he didn't even know about fucking climate change. Like, he didn't even know about that.
That was before his time.
He was dealing with all these problems.
Or no, that was after his
time. way after his time. But
way after his time.
But I mean, he was worried about the same things, but like without the added level of like, everything's going to be on fire.
Yeah, totally.
So
literally in his land too, like in his in his area.
Yeah, too. I moved out of that area and the house literally like right next to mine burned. But like right after I moved out of that direct area where he was living, you know, the Glen Ellen and Sonoma area, like that shit is all you're so right to point that out too. His beauty ranch would have been, you know, he didn't even realize the future for that and how bad it would be because of some other destructive human
practices. And like, I'm kind of glad that he didn't have that on top of him. Yeah, I know. Through, like, thank God. The last thing that man needed was his house to burn down. So, you know,
his house did burn down. His wolf.
Oh, fucking Christ.
The wolf house that he built up there, which was spectacular. And a lot of socialists ripped into him for even building such a nice, beautiful place for himself. But it was like, I know, it's like he's giving away most of his wealth, he's supporting other people, he's fighting the socialist cause. It's like, give the man a little bit to enjoy.
Yes.
And then it fucking burns down. So, and there was actually talk that, and I don't think it's probably the case, but there were some rumors that socialists burned his house down, which would be fucking awful.
Which is like 100 fucking percent against like their entire fucking belief system. Like, you fucking hypocrite.
I don't think that's true. I think it's probably that there was like a fire from something else that was going on there, you know, like, so
I hope that, I mean, I don't hope. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause that would be really despicable. Like, if you want to turn people against your cause, people that have a
voice.
That's
the way to do it.
Yeah, totally. Golly. But yeah, that, if you get a chance to go up to his beauty ranch and just do like a tour of his place, I love the life that he built for himself up there. He would start working early in the day, start writing, like wake up at 4 a.m., then like hang out in the hammock on his property and drink whiskey and read the news. And then he'd ride his horse around his ranch and check on all the different livestock and check on everything. It's just like...
Sounds like your dream day,
oh my
girl.
God, yeah. Oh my God. 1,000% my dream day.
So good. I love it.
Well, that was fucking it.
Excellent. It was, I mean, fuck, 3 episodes. We could do like 20 more.
I know, I know.
So good.
I was like rushing to cram in different chapters from his life that I was like, I can't leave this out. I can't leave this out. But I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And I
thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thanks for hanging in there with me while I did this like really fucking long topic that was multiple
episodes. No, I loved it. I'm so here for it. Like, I want to like binge listen to the 3 of them. It's so good.
Awesome. Hopefully this will drum up more enthusiasm about him as a person.
Yeah, totally. I hope the same.
Yeah, I think that's it. So should we say goodbye?
I think maybe we should. You want to say our closing piece, Erica?
Let's try to do it again together because I always love that.
I love it when we do it together. It's so good.
All right. 1, 2, 3. There's no wealth but life.
Oh my God, that sounded kind of good. I love how excited you get every single time we say shit.
I know.
You're like, oh yeah. It's so cute
because I just expect it to be like so awful.
Oh yeah, you have like shit expectations of us, Erica. No, I'm kidding.
Just the remote syncing up is like fucking impossible.
Totally.
But also so good when it works out. So
I love it.
I love you.
I love you, girl. One last cheers.
All right. Cheers, bitch.
Cheers. Mwah. Mwah. Clink.
Cheers, boozerinos.
Cheers, boozerinos.